This is January 3rd, 2016. It's one of our first tests of mindfulness every new year is how long we'll be writing, you know, the 20, in this case, 2015 instead of 2016 when we date things, or say the date, the year. I'm going to be reading and commenting on a little booklet written by a very highly esteemed Theravadan Buddhist master by the name of Ajahn Chah. I have quite limited understanding or familiarity with Theravadan masters, present or past, but this one is one of the two or three biggest names of the 20th century, 21st century. Ajahn kind of means senior teacher, like Roshi, or senior monk in the case of that. For beginners, there are two main streams of Buddhist teaching and tradition. There's the Mahayana, of which Zen is a part, where Zen is part of the Mahayana tradition, and there's the Theravada tradition, sometimes unfortunately referred to as the Hinayana, the small vehicle. Mahayana is large vehicle or great vehicle, but prefer to use the word they use, Theravada. And there are definitely differences in perspective between the Mahayana and the Theravada, but there are also similarities. Of course, it's both the Dharma. The similarities are much deeper than the differences. And I very seldom read from Theravada sources, but somehow this really spoke to me for today. It's mostly about impermanence. I think it's well established that on the whole, those of us who mark the new year seem to want to commit to greater self-discipline in all kinds of ways. I've often read that fitness clubs memberships increase in January. People go on diets in January more than any other month. And in all kinds of ways, we're trying to follow through with our New Year's resolutions. It's really the work of habit forces, this matter of freeing ourselves and living up to the best we can be, self-improvement. And there's so much, there are old books written about the power of habit and how to break habits. I think all of them acknowledge that it's exceedingly difficult to break long-standing habits, especially. But with some ways, we have a better chance than others. I think the predominant the weight of evidence is that we can't do it overnight. The most intelligent way to break bad habits and establish good ones is incrementally, little by little. Just the most common, probably the most common example is weight loss. To not try to change everything, lose a lot of weight in no time, but to work at it very persistently but modestly. This kind of thing comes up in the term intensives. We have twice a year, we have a period of several weeks where many, many people in the Sangha, both locally and out of town, commit to changes in their daily life, particularly with sitting, finding a way to find more time to sit, but in other ways as well. The theme that recurs over and over and over again is to not try to overreach in our commitments, our pledges of what we're going to do in terms of increased sitting or increased exercise. It's always, we're always walking this fine line. On the one hand, if we try to do too much too fast, it's unrealistic. We're not likely to be able to. There are exceptions. I remember one of my teacher disciples, Sante Poroma, now Roshi in Sweden, told me that when he came to his first sesshin, it was a four-day sesshin, he had been a chain smoker, and he just committed to not smoking again, and it worked. That was it. After that four-day sesshin, he never smoked again. That's really an exception. For most of us, that kind of sudden, drastic cutting off of a habit is not, doesn't have the best odds for success. So, for January Teishos, I tend to look at these things about personal change, daily life change. This time, I was foraging through my files for a topic this morning and came across this modest little booklet by this Ajahn Chah called Our Real Home. And in it he takes a much broader perspective on self, dealing with the self and its problems. Speaks of over and over about the impermanence of ourself and everything, and it really touched me in a way that I felt I should run with it now this morning. There are three characteristics or three marks of existence in Buddhism. Both Mahayana and Theravada, it's bigger than either one. And those are suffering, impermanence, and selflessness. These are very much intertwined, really. The nature of reality is impermanent. Everything is in flux. Because we haven't fully realized that, we cling to people and things and thus suffer. Because of not fully having assimilated impermanence, we become attached from a Zen perspective, mostly to our thoughts, and then as a result, we suffer in small ways and much bigger ways, and then this third mark of existence, the selflessness or no self, is what can be seen as an aspect of impermanence. If everything is in flux, and there's nothing substantial, then it applies to the self too, our ideas about the self. But here in this book, he mostly emphasizes the impermanence, that one of the three marks of existence. And I just think it's can be helpful to take the long view now and then. I very much respect the practicality of Zen and how to go about changing these habit forces that bind us to suffering, how to fortify our practice in very practical ways. But here we're just going to step back and look at the way of things, the nature of reality. I'm going to have to skip parts of this. It's as small as it is. It's only about the length of an issue of Zenbo. Just going to touch on the parts that I think are best. He begins by saying, "Today I have brought nothing material of any substance to offer you, only Dhamma." Dhamma is the Theravadan word for Dharma. They're very similar, of course, in the spelling. Only, I'll acknowledge his own. Only Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. Listen well. You should understand that even the Buddha himself, with his great store of accumulated virtue or merit, could not avoid physical death. When he reached old age, he relinquished his body and let go of its heavy burden. Now you too must learn to be satisfied with the many years you've already depended on your body. You should feel that it's enough. He seems to be, in this talk, it says here, I didn't see this until just now, a talk addressed to an aging lay disciple approaching her death. But I'm going to skip the things, some of the things, or the things that are most obviously pointed to older people. That may be another teisho, but just talk about what applies to people of any age. The Buddha said that rich or poor, young or old, human or animal, no being in this world can maintain itself in any one state for long. Everything experiences change and estrangement. This is a fact of life that we can do nothing to remedy. It's like the water of a river. It naturally flows down the gradient. It never flows against it. That's its nature. If a person was to go and stand on a river bank and seeing the water flowing swiftly down its course, foolishly wanted to flow back up the gradient, he would suffer. Whatever he was doing, his wrong thinking would allow him no peace of mind. He would be unhappy because of his wrong view, thinking against the stream. If he had right view, he would see that the water must inevitably flow down the gradient, and until he realized and accepted that fact, the person would be agitated and upset. The river that must flow down the gradient is like your body. Having been young, your body's become old, and now it's meandering toward its death. Don't go wishing it was otherwise. It's not something you have the power to remedy. The Buddha told us to see the way things are and then let go of our clinging to them. Take this feeling of letting go as your refuge. Yeah, letting go, this is one of these fundamental principles that encompasses every kind of Buddhist teaching. Certainly it applies in Zen, as we find out in our sitting. We struggle to let go of enticing thoughts that come up, arise in the mind. And that's a lot of what practice is, just letting go, letting go, letting go of any thought form or any state, not to become attached to any mental phenomenon or any physical phenomenon, just letting go, discarding, returning. We do that by returning to the breath or the koan. Very simple, and so difficult to do. He continues, let go. Let the mind unite in a single point and let that composed mind dwell with the breath. Let the breath be its sole object of knowledge. Concentrate until the mind becomes increasingly subtle, until feelings are insignificant and there is great inner clarity and wakefulness. Then when painful sensations arise, they will gradually cease of their own accord. Just to elaborate a little bit on this, this is the secret. For those of you who haven't realized how to manage physical pain while you're sitting, this is it. Just become thoroughly absorbed, more thoroughly, ever more thoroughly absorbed in the practice you're working on. And then you'll find that your experience of the pain changes. We don't have to get rid of the pain. We just have to see how it changes if we stop dwelling in thoughts of the pain. Then when painful sensations arise, they will gradually cease of their own accord. Finally, you'll look on the breath as if it was a relative come to visit you. When a relative leaves, we follow him out and see him off. We watch until he's walked or driven out of sight, and then we go back indoors. We watch the breath in the same way. If the breath is coarse, we know that it's coarse. If it's subtle, we know that it's subtle. As it becomes increasingly fine, we keep following it while simultaneously awakening the mind. So, of course, he's pointing out here that the breath changes in its and it's in various ways. It can sometimes be slower, sometimes faster, sometimes deeper, sometimes more fine and shallow. And our job in Zen practice is not to try to change whatever it is, but just to be fully with it. Here, of course, we're talking about counting or following the breath as a practice. That's the object of concentration, which is different from koan practice. With koan practice, we can kind of use the breath, but without while keeping our attention not on the breath itself, but on the koan we're working on. So not to try to change what is happening in the body, mind, and the breath. That's how, in that not trying to change things, is how we gradually, in tiny ways, awaken the mind. So let go. Put everything down, everything except the knowing. And the knowing, by that he means the awareness of what's going on in your mind. Don't be fooled if visions or sounds arise in your mind during meditation. Put them all down. Don't take hold of anything at all. Just stay with this non-dual awareness. Don't worry about the past or the future. Just be still, and you will reach the place where there's no advancing, no retreating, and no stopping, where there's nothing to grasp at or cling to. Why? Because there's no self, no me or mine. It's all gone. The Buddha taught us to be emptied of everything in this way, not to carry anything with us. To know, and having known, let go. One little comment. When we are thoroughly absorbed in the breath or the koan, there's no koan practice in Theravadan Buddhism, but it brings us to the same place. The breath or the koan, they're both concentration practices. When we are absorbed in our practice, whatever it is, to the degree that we're absorbed, we're beyond thought, and when we're beyond thought, to that degree, we're beyond self. Because self is an idea, or a cluster of ideas, or memories, or associations. That's how we empty ourselves of self, is through complete absorption in the practice we're working on. Skipping a few paragraphs here, thinking you'd like to go on living for a long time will make you suffer. But thinking you'd like to die right away or die very quickly isn't right either. It's suffering, isn't it? Conditions don't belong to us. They follow their own natural laws. You can't do anything about the way the body is. You can prettify it a little, make it look attractive and clean for a while, like the young girls who paint their lips and let their nails grow long, but when old age arrives, everyone's in the same boat. That's the way the body is. You can't make it any other way. But what you can improve and beautify is the mind. Just to go back here, conditions don't belong to us. They follow their own natural laws. The more we become familiar with stories of people dying, the more this becomes clear. There's so many cases now I've heard about and seeing with my own eyes where someone on their deathbed is ready to die. They say they are. They say, okay, it's enough now. I'm ready. I'm all right. I'm at peace. But they're announcing that doesn't mean they're going to die. That the body, and always when we say body, we mean body-mind. There's no body apart from mind. But this body-mind complex obeys its own timing, its own mandate. It can be quite amazing to see how someone in a terrible state of suffering physically, and who, because of that, really wants to let go, how often that just is not going to happen. It's just not time yet. Why? We don't know. It's not just a matter of what I want, what we want. That is It's so much bigger than that, so much more complex and subtle than just our own wishes. That last sentence, but what you can improve and beautify is the mind. Anyone can build a house of wood and bricks, but the Buddha taught that that sort of home is not our real home. It's only nominally ours. It's a home in the world, and it follows the ways of the world. Our real home is inner peace. And by the way, that's the name of this tract, this booklet, Our Real Home. An external material home may well be pretty, but it is not very peaceful. There's this worry, and then that, this anxiety, and then that. So we say it's not our real home, it's external to us. Sooner or later, we'll have to give it up. It's not a place we can live in permanently because it doesn't truly belong to us. It's part of the world. Our body is the same. We take it to be self, to be me and mine, but in fact it's not really so at all. It's another worldly home. Your body has followed its natural course from birth until now. It's old and sick and you can't forbid it from doing that. That's the way it is. Wanting it to be different would be as foolish as wanting a duck to be like a chicken. When you see that that's impossible, that a duck has to be a duck, that a chicken has to be a chicken, and that bodies have to get old and die, you will find strength and energy. However much you want the body to go on and last for a long time, it won't do that. The word sankhara refers to this body and mind. Sankharas are impermanent and unstable. Having come into being, they disappear. Having arisen, they pass away, and yet everyone wants them to be permanent. This is foolishness. Look at the breath. Having come in, it goes out. That's its nature. That's how it has to be. The inhalation and exhalation have to alternate. There must be change. Sankharas exist through change. You can't prevent it. Just think, could you exhale without inhaling? Would it feel good? Or could you just inhale? We want things to be permanent, but they can't be. It's impossible. Once the breath has come in, it must go out. When it's gone out, it comes in again, and that's natural, isn't it? Having been born, we get old and sick, and then we die, and that's totally natural and normal. It's because sankharas have done their job, because the in-breaths and out-breaths have alternated in this way, that the human race is still here today. Let me just pause and point out that no one, I think, would dispute what he's saying because it's so self-evident. Change, this example of the breath, the fact of our declining in age and our mental and physical functions declining, no one would dispute this. The problem is that unconsciously, probably mostly unconsciously, we deny it. We don't really, really accept it. And that's where I'm going to say the absolute importance of meditation is, where that comes, is that meditation is a way to learn it through the body. That's the only real learning, is experiencing it, to hear it in words. Okay, yeah, sure, I get it. But do you get it? Does any of us get it without really experiencing it over time and coming to really know it. And we come to know it as we find a way to get beyond our thoughts. Our thoughts prevent us from real knowing, real wisdom. They're like a block. So we read these kinds of texts, and they can be reminders. Yes, of course. Of course, everything is in flux. We can't hold on to anything. And reminders can be very helpful. But when all is said and done, it comes down to the direct experience. And that's how the Zen sect has always been understood, as the school of direct experience. We find out through sitting on a daily basis. We find out for ourselves that the thoughts and everything else, every other body-mind state, does not last. It's all in flux. We experience it for ourselves. And that takes, for most of us, it takes an awfully long time before that really sinks in, before we really assimilate these truths that Ajahn Chah is offering us. And he continues, as soon as we're born, we're dead. Our birth and our death are just one thing. It's like a tree. When there's a root, there must be twigs. When there are twigs, there must be a root. You can't have one without the other. It's a little funny to see how at a death, people are so grief-stricken and distracted, tearful and sad, and at a birth, how happy and delighted. It's delusion. Nobody has ever looked at this clearly. I think if you really want to cry, then it would be better to do so when someone's born. Yeah, who's going to do that? What parents or in-laws or grandparents are going to do that? You see here, seriously, you see here the unique perspective of a monk. Those of us with families, especially with children, it would be unnatural to try to grieve when someone was, our child or grandchild was born. It would be ridiculous. But he's pointing out that, yes, as in a worldly sense, no one could be expected to do that, but that doesn't change the way things are. The way things are, as soon as we're born, we're doomed to die. That you can't really separate the two in the deepest sense. We all have a terminal illness. It's called life. For, he continues, for actually birth is death. Death is birth. The root is the twig. The twig is the root. If you've got to cry, cry at the root. Cry at the birth. Look closely. If there was no birth, there would be no death. Can you understand this? Don't think a lot. Just think, this is the way things are. It's your work, your duty. Right now, nobody can help you. There's nothing that your family and your possessions can do for you. All that can help you now is the correct awareness. So don't waver. Let go. Throw it all away. So you needn't worry about anything, because this isn't your real home. It's just a temporary shelter. Having come into this world, you should contemplate its nature. Everything there is preparing to disappear. Look at your body. Is there anything there that's still in its original form? Is your skin as it used to be? Is your hair? It's not the same, is it? Where has everything gone? This is nature, the way things are. When their time is up, conditions go their way. This world is nothing to rely on. It's an endless round of disturbance and trouble, pleasures and pain. There's no peace. Yeah, too many people who hear this, they'll be quick to label it as just pessimistic. But that's unfair. I would say it's not optimistic, but nor is it pessimistic. It's realistic. This is the way things are. This is the way, the Tao, the Dharma. Until we clearly, directly face this way, we are bound to suffer unnecessarily. There's plenty of pain that is unavoidable with the human body-mind, but then there's also this suffering that is avoidable, and it comes from failing to see and live in accordance with this Dharma that he's reminding us of. When we have no real home, we're like an aimless traveler out on the road, going this way for a while, and then that way, stopping for a while, and then setting off again. Until we return to our real home, we feel ill at ease whatever we're doing, just like one who's left his village to go on a journey. Only when he gets home again can he really relax and be at ease. So just from a Zen perspective, what is this? What is this real home? It's that which is beyond phenomena, mental and physical phenomena. It's this realm of no mind. It is that which is beyond change. It's the sky behind the clouds. There's just this formless, featureless sky. That's our real home. Not the clouds that come and go, that shift and change in form. And every time we can, every moment, every second, we can be fully with the breath, that we're with the sky, we're in the sky, we are the sky. Or leaving aside the breath, because people doing breath practice don't do that when they're not sitting. That's not, you're not trying when you're talking to someone or driving or anything else, taking a shower. You're not trying to follow the breath, but what we are trying to do is to be detached from thoughts. That detachment, and with it comes awareness, with that detachment is our real home. The abiding in awareness itself and not getting caught in the content of things, the thoughts. Nowhere in the world is any real peace to be found. The poor have no peace, and neither do the rich. Adults have no peace. Children have no peace. The poorly educated have no peace, and neither do the highly educated. There's no peace anywhere. That's the nature of the world. Of course, he's talking not about moments or hours here and there of peace, but any real, enduring peace, sustained peace of mind. Anyone who thinks otherwise has not really examined the nature of the mind. Those who have a few possessions suffer, and so do those who have many. Children, adults, the aged, everyone suffers. The suffering of being old, the suffering of being young, the suffering of being wealthy, and the suffering of being poor, it's all nothing but suffering. To be fair, it's suffering that many people find a way to live with. It's just, they imagine that suffering is just our what we have to resign ourselves to, but it's not. That's where practice comes in. We find through practice that we can reduce or mitigate our suffering. Who wouldn't want to do that? When you realize that that's the way the world is, you'll feel that it's a wearisome place. When you see that there's nothing stable or substantial you can rely on, you'll feel wearied and disenchanted. Being disenchanted doesn't mean you're averse, though. Let me say a bit about that. Disenchanted, think of it as literally free of enchantment. It's like being disillusioned, or free of illusion. It doesn't mean depressed. Who wouldn't want to be free of illusion? The mind is clear. It sees that there's nothing to be done to remedy this state of affairs. It's just the way the world is. Knowing in this way, you can let go of attachment, let go with a mind that is neither happy nor sad, but at peace. What's important is that we should build our own home, building it by the method that I've been explaining to you. Build your home. Let go. Let go until the mind reaches the peace that is free from advancing, free from retreating, and free from stopping still. Pleasure is not our home. Pain is not our home. Pleasure and pain both decline and pass away. I think nothing is more important to the motivation to practice than facing squarely the impermanence of things. And again, this is something that most of us find a way to evade, to distract ourselves from this fact, this truth of impermanence. The more we practice, the less we'll be able to do that. This is a fair warning that you're not going to be able to deny. You're not going to be able to live in a state of denial as much as you go on practicing. But of course, living in a state of denial is hardly a way to use this precious human body-mind. It's one of the great things about getting older is it becomes harder and harder to deny impermanence, to deny decline. When we're young, well, it's easy as pie. Older people tell you you're going to get old someday, you're going to lose so much of what you take for granted in your mind and in your body, and it means nothing when you're young. For almost all young people, that's just, well, as Andy Rooney said, to the young, death is just a distant rumor. It's all just a distant rumor. Decline is a distant rumor. What young people do have going for them, is in terms of motivation to practice, is a kind of what I could think it could be called a more acute suffering. The suffering of taking the self so seriously. When we're younger, it's all about oneself. Self-consciousness is much stronger in young people than older people. And that self-consciousness in its many forms is so painful. And that is a great spur to practice. That's the great fuel for practice when you're young. When we get older, that self-consciousness declines as the self becomes more porous. Somehow, just through aging, you see this in people, older people who don't practice, who've never practiced. There's a kind of lightness or porousness, a way in which they just don't take themselves so seriously. They don't make everything into a drama about the self, at least not as much. Of course, there are different individual differences. Some people may go on doing that into very advanced age, but on the whole, older people have that. They don't have that same kind of pain, that basic self-oriented pain. But what we do have as we get older is this growing awareness of things as a limitation of time, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. So in the end, it levels off, more or less. Whether we're old or young, we all have plenty that we can draw from to keep us going in practice, if we can only face it. And we do that more and more through daily practice. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.